Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. We are about to begin part two of an education forum recorded at Carroll High School earlier this month. The moderator for the event was Andy Downs. Thank you for listening.
I'd like to try and merge together the topic, one of the parts we discussed in the first section, and now. Clearly, you're not big fans of testing, we understand that, but you're fans of accountability, and that makes perfect sense. If someone is awarded a choice scholarship and they use that at a non-public school, what's the version of accountability for that? Who'd like to take a stab at that?
Well, we don't have it. We have fire and safety are the main two things that the state does for voucher schools. They have to have safe schools, and they have to have fire exits and routines and all the things that you're supposed to do. That's basically the only two main things that they have. So it's up to the parents to make that choice, and then those schools, which are, Phil mentioned, I don't know how many, probably 97% are connected to churches in Indiana.
Well, they're still required for the ILM test, correct?
I don't know.
Yeah, they have to be accredited. They're accredited. If they're accredited,
I think they do that. They do. Their students take ILEARN, I think. Yeah.
To continue to receive voucher money.
And so accreditation would be one way to look at accountability for non-public schools.
Yes.
Are there other suggestions for how we might look at accountability for non-public schools receiving those dollars through families with the choice scholarships?
I don't know if anything else that's specific, because
they take the test. They take the whatever the test of the day is. ILEARN.
Well, you have to understand, also, to be a voucher recipient school, I should back up. I'm really looking at something else. I'm talking about when you have a grantor an authorizer, they have their own accountability standards.
If those are charters.
That's a charter. Though. Yeah, I got backwards on that.
Well, that's what you're saying.
Representative Giaquina? You looked like you wanted to say something.
I was thinking, I've talked to Kathy Friend before. She's the controller for the former community schools, and she will say, we have to do, and I don't have the examples, I'm sorry, but she'll say, we have to do these sorts of things with regards to accountability and where the money's going and those sorts of things, which the voucher schools do not have to. So those dollars are unaccounted for.
The dollars aren't unaccounted for. The dollars aren't unaccounted for.
What I said.
You said the dollars are unaccounted for.
What'd you say? Yes.
We know where the dollars are going. They're not unaccounted for.
Well,
they put in their head count. The child is eligible. That dollar goes with that child, and they're going to the school.
And the dollars go to the school. I mean, I think there's this whole notion that it stops or something. The dollars go to the school. I mean, I think I understand it goes to the parent for legal terms, but it goes to the school, and then what the school does with them, I assume they pay and remodel their buildings and do new steeples, which they did at St. Jude's, I think, or something. Yeah, they did.
My parish. So
yeah,
let's.
And it was recorded. Yeah.
No,
yes, it was.
They
and
didn't.
It was on recording,
oh,
and I heard
on,
it.
Phil.
And they were using the money to help rebuild the steeple.
No,
at
we
the
didn't.
Church. And so that's where. So those dollars are unaccounted for. We've had a long week, so maybe we're getting a little cranky. I'm not really sure. Probably more me than anybody else. So.
This might be the right time to move to our third subject area, which is the role of public education in the 21st century. There is no single view of the purpose of public education. In fact, we've heard here this evening people talk about vocational education, preparing for four-year college, preparing to go out into the workforce right away. There is no one view for that. And so I'd like to start by asking each of you what you think the purpose of public education is to come in the next, let's say, century. Make it a small window. Start with Representative Abbott.
I'll start in on that one. Well, I don't know if I can go the full century. I didn't even think we'd have computers when I was in high school, but so I can maybe go 25, 30 years. I think that what's really the driving force, and I think we've seen it in Europe, and that's what some of the career pathways are leading to, is preparing our youth for the changing economic environment. We've gone to a STEM-type society with technical requirements. So the career pathways, I think, is what... everything is an experiment. We work, we adjust, we try to refine. Right now, the idea is to try to identify students at an earlier time before graduation. And, you know, in my day, we graduate, and a lot of guys would go out and get a job and figure out what they want to do. We're trying to identify, and some of the European countries, even Asia, have done this as early as eighth grade. Apprenticeship programs, actually getting paid to work, you know, like we do something like the Impact Program. You go out and spend half a day. They've been doing this. They're finding where kids, you know, they may say they want to be a welder. One of the ways they do that in some of the European nations is they get credit for college while they're being a welder. If they decide they change, they want to go to get a four-year degree, they want to become a doctor, they can carry credits over. So that's just one example. But, you know, there's different pathways people want to take. I think the thing that needs to be refined is how do teachers and administrators, how do we identify where the strengths of our children are? Because we have a real changing economic. We don't know where it's going to be. You know, to me, it was computers. We don't know what it's going to be in 20, 30, 40 years, but I think we need to be prepared so that we have the tools in place to be able to identify those needs in before we're ready to graduate high school, early on, eighth grade even. You know, kids learn more, their brains are developing as kindergartners, and I think the whole process, K through 12, needs to be a learning experience for our teachers, for our students to learn, and as we're progressing through that, at an earlier age, I think we're finding that we need to find where their strengths are so we can prepare them for the workforce or for whatever career they want to be in. And let's face it, it's career development. Everyone's going to go out and get a job, so why not prepare them better at an earlier time? And I think that's going to be the challenge. Where it's going to come out, I don't know, but I think we're going to find some more very more entrepreneur-type ideas coming forward, and I think that's what we need to focus on as far as our education needs. Not everybody's in college, not everybody's in the workforce, there's a lot of multitudes. So the career pathways, I think, is the idea is great, how that ends up coming out in the long run, I'm sure it's gonna be completely different than what we've got now, but I see that changing in that direction.
Representative Giaquinta?
Kind of on the same line, I think we probably all four of us have been to New Tech High School at Wayne. Mm-hmm. And I really like the school, and I like how the students work in groups and teams and things like that to that really kind of prepares them to go out and get into the business community where you have to work on groups and teams for different projects. I really like that idea. That might be kind of a fun model to watch. We saw a robot today on the House floor. The robotics team. I forget what.
That was really impressive.
Yeah, I forget what. Yes. That was really neat. And And I think what they stressed the most was sort of the hands-on education they received there, where they actually got to, you know, work on this thing and work on this robot. Wasn't developed it in about 6 weeks, I think they said. So, like Representative Abbott said, something like a New Tech school or really can prepare you specifically to get into the field that you're looking to get into.
Mm-hmm. Senator Brown?
I'm going to jump back in. I can't help this. I came from an engineering background as my career before I retired when I had my real job. But, we worked as groups as engineers. We had a project. We developed it, and that's what I saw today. I saw these kids, and they put something together in 6 weeks with teamwork. And I've seen it in the schools. I've been here in Northrop. I've seen it. All the schools are doing it. And we don't see classrooms in a row anymore. It's a change. It's working towards that group project-oriented development, and you watch them how they're figuring out, they're working together. That's the real world. That's how it works out there. Although I don't know how they did it in 6 weeks, because we would have had 13 weeks to do it. So my hat went off to them, and I think the speaker was pretty impressed too.
Senator Brown.
Well, I mean, 30 years ago, education did not look the way it does today. And so I guess I'm a little more cautious. I know that the cost of a four-year degree is daunting, and the value, which we didn't talk about tonight, obviously, of what that four-year degree means anymore is maybe not as significant. But I worry about the quality of that. And so I do think there's an important role for our children to have some skills as they come out of high school, particularly those. I don't think we should be pushing everyone into higher ed. I have always voiced my concerns about how much money is lost on 21st century scholars, where kids get these opportunities and they go and then they don't finish. And I'm not sure that's helpful for them. And maybe we didn't do a good enough job of getting them there. So my point is, we need to get them better prepared and spend the money in the K-12 for whatever they're going to do afterwards. But since I'm a little bit older too, and took the Iowa Basic Skills, but not quite as long ago as Senator Cruz, I think it is interesting because when I was in high school, there was the secretarial track, and you took steno and typing and home ec or not. And so I never learned how to type, and because I wasn't in that track. But I can cook, but that was an accident. So now we're back to that, you know, and those are important soft skills. I mean, the skills we're teaching today are probably better than those classes, but we teach those soft skills. So I still think, though, every child needs to know how to write well and read at their level and do some math. And so I'm always I'm a little nervous because we are pushing these alternative programs on them, which I think is great, but there are late bloomers, and you don't want to set them up for a job skill that only takes them here, and they don't have the skill to go back for some other degree. So I don't know what it'll look like. We probably thought 10 years ago everything would be online, and I certainly don't think at the level we're here that that's great. I think children need that socializing and the interaction and things like that. And I worry about the group thing, because anybody who's had to do a group class back in the day realizes there's always one slacker, there's one overachiever, and then and there's everybody else, right? So the project gets done, but so I don't know about that either. So that's not really an answer, I guess, but I do. I kind of worry that that's why, you know, when we talked earlier about CTE funding and where we're going, it's this balancing act, you know? I'm sure you teachers can't believe those of us who had the opportunities to go to school see it occasionally. I mean, just getting children to show up on time, because that's what employers say, and have their work done and be attentive, et cetera, et cetera. And yes, they have more stressors in their life than they did. Nobody had this. And when my kids graduated, this was banned. They had them. Now you let them use them in the classroom, and it's pervasive, so you have to work around it. So anyway, that's a very long, I guess, not answer to say, I don't know what it is, and so we're always going to be behind in terms of trying to figure it out. And that's always my worry. You know, as soon as we're saying teach this, it's defunct, and then here's the next thing, you know, and everybody keeps talking about the Zuckerbergs of the world who dropped out, or Bill Gates or whatever. Okay, that's the one-off, and that's not who we should be holding up to our children, because I'm old school. I think it's great if kids have a broad liberal arts background, and that's what I worry about, that we're pulling too much away from that.
So I do want to remind everyone that Senator Cruz is not seeking re-election right now, so in addition to having all of that experience, he has the luxury of not needing to worry about what voters think, so I'm expecting the most interesting answer from you.
Well, I believe, you said 100 years from now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You can shorten that if you wish.
Yeah, but I think technology will grow and be a bigger part of education. And along with that, I think one of the most fundamental things, and Senator Brown was alluding to, soft skills to employers are more important in many jobs than your knowledge of any particular job you may have learned by a book. I've had many employers tell me, if you give me a person who shows up to work, they work hard, they get along with other people, they don't get sick a lot, they have good personal habits, and you know, they follow instructions. If you get a kid that does all those things, and I'll teach him how to work this machine, or I'll teach him how to do this accounting procedure in my office. And so I think you'll have that development over the period of the next 100 years of making sure you got those soft skills, because once you got the soft skills down, then you can learn that technical part or the adaptive part to learn that particular job from the employer. So I think the employer themselves are going to get more involved in the educational process. I think we're in the beginnings of that now. I think that's going to be a bigger deal. So I think you'll see far more apprentices and on-the-job training. Like I was, when I went to college and become a teacher, I did student teaching my senior year one semester. So I didn't know. Here I was going to college. In my case, I went 5 years to get my diploma because I went to Anderson University in between IPFW 2 years each. And, you know, I'd never been in a classroom than to actually be a teacher. Well, now when you're in teacher education classes, you go as a freshman, you go into the classroom and you monitor and you watch and see what's going on. You interact with the teachers, and they do that all 4 years to get a teaching degree. So I think you'll see more and more of that with all employers saying, hey, I want to, if this person has this bent that they want to follow this path, and you can change your path, but that path, then he needs to go off to the factory and work there for a few hours a week or whatever, just to see what's going on in here, to see if that works for him. And if he doesn't like it, then I'll go do something else and see how that works in my life. So I think you'll see the K through 8 become more important for the basic educational knowledge, academic knowledge. And then you'll see as you get into high school, I think you'll see more of the apprenticeship and the employers getting involved in that, and then make sure we got the right soft skills.
Several of you brought up earlier the fact that school boards control a number of things as far as education is concerned, and one of the tensions that exists in Indiana has for 200 years, probably will for another century, is who should have control, state government or local government. How do you see that playing out here, especially as the state took over funding for educators' pay? I mean, that's a significant investment. You should have some say, but it's a difficult balancing act here, and we'll start once again with Senator Cruz, given his love of local government as a former trustee.
Yes. So, you know, we talk back and forth of state control, federal government control, local control, local government control. We bounce back and forth in any given bill. I'll switch. I'll vote for this for state control, and the next bill I'll say, oh, I think this is good for local control. So it goes back and forth. And he alluded to the book, but we have a 1,500-page book of the state government micromanaging K through 12 education in Indiana. I mean, it's horrendous. I got it on my shelf in my office down at the State House, and I would love to at least cut that in half. And I've been making different efforts to try to get that done. Hopefully that'll happen, and we got a bill this time that'll actually take away a lot of the state regulations from the K-12 public schools. So I think we over-regulate the K-12 public schools. I think the school boards and the principals and teachers can manage a lot of this stuff just as effective as we can from the State House in Indianapolis. So I think that it's a combination of different things, just like CPR training or bullying or something. You know, bullying is a big problem for lots of kids and stuff. And so if every school was left to do that, some schools wouldn't have any bullying policies. You know, some would have big, good bullying policies. So there are different times where, you know, we think, well, as a state, we ought to make sure that all the schools do this. Every, you know, somebody in the school ought to know CPR in case the kid, you know, has a, whatever happens. So. So it's always a battle between that balance of state and local control, and I think it does go back and forth. And we did the deal taking over the operating budget of the schools with the state dollars was primarily done to try to balance out sales income and property taxes. Property taxes are getting a little too high, and so we thought we ought to balance that out. So we raised our state taxes and lowered the real estate taxes. And some people like that, some people don't like that, but one of the consequences is that it actually gives less control of money of the school board. I go back and forth in almost any given category of education. I think almost all the legislators will go back and forth of whether it should be state or local control.
Mm-hmm. Senator Brown, a former council member, city council member.
Yeah, it is a struggle. I mean, we spend almost $15 billion, and so we have an obligation to make sure all those dollars are being spent appropriately. So you struggle with that, but you have local school boards who then decide on the other half of the money that goes into that, and they have a responsibility. And for every great school system, and we have great school systems in Northeast Indiana, there are those outliers like a Gary, which are a significant drain, not on the, just on the state, but also on their community, which is more important. So getting back to, I think a public education and a public school system is the most important thing a community can have. It's the fundamental background. It's not just educating your students. It's going to decide the strength of your community and the strength of your state. And we've seen communities that don't have strong public school systems suffer. And so you hope that the school boards do their job and that they appreciate the gravity. When I was on city council, and probably to this day, I don't know what the city's budget is, but the school's budget was higher than the city council's budget. And, you know, it's pretty mind-boggling to have a school board meet once a month and make these significant decisions over millions and millions of dollars and make hard decisions on personnel and football fields and extracurriculars and all of those things. So, but a huge task for a school board member, but certainly better suited than us at the state to do that. So getting back to that, you struggle. Two or three years ago, we had discussions on suicide awareness and pushing that into the schools and requiring it. That's taking away local control, and there are probably some who didn't want it, don't think it's necessary, thought it was going to be an expense, whatever the case was. But those are the kinds of issues you look at and you think, how can we not do that? We had an issue yesterday in Health Committee, and we had the officials saying no, all the state officials for school boards and teachers and everything, no, you decide. We don't want local control on this issue. We want you to make this decision. So, you know, it is. It's a balancing act.
Representative Giaquinto?
Yeah, I tend to be a local control person, but I'm sure you could find a vote that I cast that I contradicted myself.
Someone's researching it already.
Exactly. I can probably tell you one. My colleagues are, you know, right. We can be sort of all over the map sometimes, and it. But you know, we do have elected school boards, and just in general, with regards to local control, you know, it is hard for folks to come down to Indianapolis. I talked to you one time. You were coming down to testify on a bill in the middle of a blizzard. I think you might have made it. I can't remember. Maybe you had to turn around and go home. But it can be difficult for folks to get off work and come down and testify on a bill. Obviously, there's other ways of having your voice heard too. But yeah, I mean, I tend to be more for local control, and the state legislature. Vote for the budget, the money sends to the school boards, and they have to do with it what they best see fit. And folks don't like it, they can go complain and speak at the next school board meeting.
Representative Abbott.
Well, being from my past, I was many years in president of our town council, and then I was county commissioner before I had this job. So I was a local control guy. I didn't like the state stepping in when I didn't think they should step in, but that being said, there were times they needed to step in. You know, we're elected positions. Whether you're a commissioner, council, school board, you're responsible and accountable to your constituents. Otherwise, you're not going to have a job. But now I'm in a state position. And now I'm looking back, and my words of wisdom that were told to me, don't forget where you came from. I can, you know, it's a very tough balancing act. You see things at a state level that you never saw at a local level. And with that knowledge, you have to discern where you need to have your hands in there like a parent or not. And just to give you one example, in Government Regulatory Commission Reform Committee meeting that we had yesterday, we took testimony on township assessors. We used to have township assessors everywhere. I mean, I forget how many years ago that was, maybe 11 years ago. There was a statute passed, and you could pass a referendum. I think we have close to 1,000 townships, something like that. All but 13 voted to eliminate township assessor, And this bill right now is addressing, and it's coming to us, to what to do with these 13. We had testimony where they could save up to $2.5 million a year up in Lake County if they eliminated the township trust assessor and had that come into the county assessor. There was a lot more efficiency and a lot more cost savings that could be done by that. And we had testimony from that, not that township assessor, by no means, that he wanted to keep his job. But the government, the officials in that area testified that they thought that was a great idea. Yeah, I don't know where that's going to come out, but it sometimes as a state level, you look at that and you think, you have to decide what is best in this case. Because is it a local, or where does the state come in, where is the local? And you know, sometimes you have to stand up and say, I think somebody needs to make a decision here. So,
Representative Jubina.
So this is very interesting. I actually watched that committee.
Okay.
And
I didn't want to mention names, but go ahead.
Well, in fact, I wrote it down. I didn't want to get into township assessor stuff here. But so in 2008, we passed a law bill that said all these assessors were going to be, it was going to be put to referendum whether or not your township wanted to keep their local township assessor. And in Allen County, most of them were eliminated except for one, which is the Wayne Township assessor. By the way, overwhelmingly, the voters in Wayne Township wanted to keep their assessor. And now here, 12 years later, we have a bill to undo what the local folks, what those local people did and asked at a referendum in Wayne Township. And to me then, why do we have any referendum at all now going forward? If we're just gonna undo what the people decided what they wanted to do. We tasked them with this, here you go, here's your referendum, vote up or down. Many were eliminated, the vast majority as you said, but there are a few still remaining. Those folks in those communities voted to keep their assessor, and I think they should be allowed to do so because that's what the legislature tasked them to do.
We're about to see a pretty significant shift in elected officials in Indiana in that the superintendent of public instruction will no longer be elected. Some people are saying that's great. The governor will get to appoint that person. There will be alignment between those two individuals and things will be more efficient. Other people are saying, but wait, what about minority voices? What about voices that are not those of the governor? What's your perspective on replacing the elected position with an appointed position? And have you been thinking about a mechanism or mechanisms by which those who are not in agreement will be able to have their voice heard? And we'll start with Representative Abbott on this one.
Well, I know the as far as the appointment goes, in my understanding, the idea behind it is this gives more flexibility under a voted an election procedure. I don't want to say anybody can run for that. We've had some good, very good experience with qualified people that have run for that position. I think the appointment, in my opinion, allows the governor to search out as you would as a job search for someone that has the highest qualifications, minimum education backgrounds, minimum qualifications in the workplace that could best fit the job and give him more flexibility to have someone that would be in that position that has all of the experiences needed for that. I don't want to throw out political names, but Mitch Daniels, in my opinion, is a good example. When he was appointed to the Purdue I don't want to say chancellor, but president of Purdue, you know, he's done a remarkable job. They've frozen tuition over the last several years, and he's run that like clockwork, if you want to say, and Purdue University has been very successful with that, and that's attributed to an appointment. Now, not to say there couldn't be an elected person, but I think it's a good direction, and it gives a lot of authority to the governor. I mean, we have a lot of appointed positions, but as far as the little guy, as far as that goes, I honestly don't have a good answer for that. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know how that will play out in this particular type. Normally, you have a board of directors that that appointed chairman or director would respond to or be accountable to, and then those directors are accountable to others below them, like constituents that represent that sector of the industry. I would probably see something similar to that. There would be some kind of an accountability through the surrounding. people that he or she would answer to in addition to the governor, the officer, I'm not sure. And I honestly don't have a good answer for that.
Senator Brown?
Well, I think, in an ideal world, the superintendent of education would be nonpartisan, but unfortunately, that's not always the case. And so I guess if we're going to fund that position, so to speak, or the policies that stem from that, then at least you'd like to see it less acrimonious than it has been in some of the past administrations. And so my hope is at least a voter who is, in this case, going to be voting for a governor and voting for their priorities and voting for legislators who are going to vote a budget in that may or may not match those priorities if they're the same party. Then you have that system. And then over here, currently, you have a superintendent's position that may or may not always mesh with that. And so it has become not always easy to get things done there. I'm not on education committee again, I say, but I certainly think the State Board of Education and the superintendent's office and the back and forth that we had at this first go-round was not appropriate and not helpful to moving forward to what our goal should be, is to making sure we have the best public education system in the country, K through 12 and our higher ed. And so my hope is that the person that will assume that role, since Superintendent McCormick had said, A, she was comfortable with the decision to make it an appointment, and then B, decided not to run again anyway, so I'm going to assume it won't be her, but I would hope that whoever fills that position will be in line with the educational policies of the state. And then that's a voter decision. If you don't like where the educational system is going, then you'll be able to put all of your political capital, if you will, behind that, instead of having this disparate system that we have now. And I shouldn't say it's disparate. It may seem that times. I actually think when my interactions on a much smaller scale with Department of Education inquiring about some policy or curriculum or something is always been fruitful, very helpful. And so I maybe that's part of it too. It looks like, because the political life right now in the political world, it seems so acrimonious. It really isn't. And so maybe taking politics out of the superintendent's position ultimately will get what we want, someone who is working on policy and not worrying about their election or whether it's a D or R behind their name, and just what's the best policy for our students in our schools. So that's my hope anyway.
Representative Giaquina?
Kind of like the superintendent of public instruction being separately elected, because it's makes he or she a little more independent of the governor's office. Several times last session, my office went down to talk to Superintendent McCormick about some ideas talk to her regarding some amendments, some different things, and try to work with her. Might not be able to do that. Well, who knows? I don't know, but may not be able to do that if it's someone that's working in the governor's administration. So that you lose that independence. But Senator Brown, exactly right. It will be. You're now voting for the governor and the education policy, since the governor will presumably appoint some type of, I don't know what the position will be called, but some type of superintendent to handle his education, his policies and platforms and things like that. So it definitely will rest with the governor and for him, he or she, in the next 4 years. So we know where that person will, where they'll stand on the issues, and people can vote accordingly.
And finally, Senator Cruz.
Well, I'm a big proponent, and I lost of an election of the superintendent of public instruction. I've always been that way, and I think when we have our separation of powers, and in each one of those separation of powers, I think you have a balance of power within each of those three parts of the government. And the executive branch, I think our forefathers was wise in electing the treasurer, electing the auditor, and electing the secretary of state separately, because within that executive branch, I think if the governor is the only one elected, then I think he has too much power. And I think we need to have that checks and balances within the executive branch. And I think it's better to have more elected people. And I just, to me, that's better, I think, for the voters and for the public in general to have more choices of more people who represent them in their government. That's why I still am a defender of township government, because you elect those people who are closest to you in the county government, in the cities and towns and counties. I think it's important to keep those people elected, and I think we should have kept the superintendent as an elected position, and I felt terrible when we lost that battle, but we've been fighting it for a long time.
We have what I hope are two sort of quick and I'll say even easy questions. We're going to start with Senator Brown. Top legislative priority doesn't have to necessarily be education, but if there's a piece of education legislation that's exciting to you this session, what is it? And if not, what's your top priority other than that?
Well, Superintendent Hemsel referenced some legislation that he had brought to me about changing some of the way our code talks about accountability for teachers and the dual credit reimbursement payment for teachers who teach dual credit classes. So that's legislation I filed. I'm hopeful it actually emanated from Superintendent Hemsel, wasn't my idea. And my biggest, right now I'm on the health committee and I'm carrying some significant health related bills that hopefully will make it more transparent and reduce costs, which is a huge hope. So.
Senator Cruz.
I think health issues is probably the number one issue for our state government in the legislative process this session. I think we've got a lot of things that we have to deal with in that area. I mean, vaping was one of the big things that we lacked, having a good law. And I think having the state government raise smoking up to 21 for everybody is a good thing to do, too. I favor that. And the federal government kind of beat us in doing that. But I think also we have problems with our health insurance companies, drug companies, and now we got an in-between, I forget what they call them now, but
PBMs.
What are they?
PBMs. Pharmaceutical.
Between the pharmacies and the drug companies. And now those companies are so big, they're billion-dollar companies making all kinds of profits, and they weren't designed to do that way. They're supposed to be a little more systematic and having more accountability and transparency on health insurance coverage. And if you're getting treatment and somehow or another a different person comes in and they're not in your network, and instead of being covered 90%, you pay 90% out of your pocket, and that shocks a lot of people. So I think there's a bunch of health issues that are pretty important that we need to deal with.
Representative Abbott.
I couldn't agree more with what he just said. In addition, I'll add a cost portal that we're looking at so that people, when they go out to get a procedure done, they can get costs ahead of time instead of getting a surprise bill later and find out that knee surgery, they could have got it a lot cheaper because they're going to pay a good percentage of, you know, especially with the high deductible. So I think that's a third part of that health. I guess going back to the other one, vaping, I'm very concerned about that. I went to Concord High School, which is up in my other northwest part of my district. I'm upside down. But we listened to students that made a presentation. Two students had a beautiful PowerPoint presentation, this is last May, about vaping and the problems in the schools. And the kids they have the little jewels and they hide it in their head, and the teacher can't catch them when they turn. I asked a question to one of the superintendents, how come you don't ban it? Says, we do, we just can't catch them. And we sat there, there was a couple of us legislators were there, county commissioners were there, county council was there, health department was there, and superintendents were there from a couple school corporations. And they said, help us. They were pleading for help, help us. We can't even use the restrooms. And it's rampant. And not one person had a suggestion, not one. It's like, God, that is really bad, we're sorry. And I decided that's when we need to do something. So I started a bill on my own on banning T21 for tobacco, for vaping, and then also banning flavors, and then a couple other things too. I found out another Representative Ellsworth, he was doing it, so I agreed to, look, you carried it last year, but you know, I'll be glad to co-author. So he put his things into my bill. Well, now there's a number of us doing this, so we've got one person as a point person. I'm co-author on that bill too. But I think that the vaping is really, it's critical. It's epidemic, and I think that's my number one priority. My TIF bill, I mentioned that. I think that's really important, because I think that will help in a small way for schools, but it will help overall for taxpayers to try to release some of these captured incremental assessed valuation dollars that are tied up in TIFs that have gone beyond their useful life. So I won't go on anything. I've got a number of bills I'm carrying, but I'll cut it here.
You want your veterans too?
Is that
your veterans bill?
I've got one. Actually, the Military and Veterans Coalition approached me, General Bowery, wanted to know if I would carry a bill in the Honor and Remember flag. And can you do that?
Oh, I didn't mean that. No, that's a good
that's
one.
That's personal to me. We lost our son.
Yeah.
In the Iraq War.
Thank you.
So what this flag is, Honor and Remember flag, it honors the fallen and the families of the fallen. So what we're going to do is for the entire month of May, mandate that flag is flown over every state building. Now, we don't, here's where I am, local control. I don't think we should mandate schools, cities, towns. If they want to fly it, great. Fly it 365 days a year. I would love that. Our idea is that, the state, we can at least step up to the plate and say, let's honor these people, not one day a year, but for at least 30 days, and doesn't prohibit anybody from, honoring it more so. That's a bill I'm really excited about.
I think Representative Giaquinta technically yielded some of his time there, so he will be the fastest on this question.
Very quickly, we'll keep beating the drum for increase in teacher pay and try to expand school safety grants so more schools around the state can take advantage of that.
And then the absolute last thing, part of the reason this happened is the Charger Advocates or a group of parents who are looking for ways to become more engaged with folks. What's your preferred method of communication, if you don't mind telling the folks who are watching, listening, what's the best way to get in touch with you? We'll start with Representative Giaquinta.
I've been receiving texts while I'm sitting up here from you all in the audience, so just one. Email, text, it doesn't really matter. Come down and see us, too, really. I encourage that if you can. And I'm going to vouch for all my colleagues here. All three of them are very accessible. I know they are. And, when I go to these discussions and panels throughout the district, I can usually count on these three to show up. They really do. And we all try to be accessible. We'll come out and see if you come down and visit us, and we'll show you around and talk about the issues. So, yep.
Yeah. Representative Abbott, favorite way to be contacted?
I have my email address. Anyone who wants to come up to me, I give my personal email out. I don't usually broadcast it to, online. It's not on my card, but I will give it to anybody. I'm readily available, my phone number or my personal email. So, and I encourage you to text me or email me and call me anytime you feel like it.
Senator Cruz?
I like face-to-face, out of session. So I like, if you have a concern, I like to talk to you person to person ahead of time, not when we're at the State House. When we're at the State House, the demands on our time are so great, it's hard to almost say hi to it. I mean, Steve Cronin and I have known each other for decades, and I hate for him to come down to the State House, and I've got a committee meeting I got to go to, I got to go to this, I got to do that, and I can say hi to him in the hallway and maybe get 30 seconds with him, and I think that's a travesty. I don't like that, so I like it better when we could have lunch together or go to a school board meeting or something outside a session, visit the schools, which I've done many times, dozens of times, maybe hundreds of times now. But I just like the one-on-one, or even with a smaller group. I meet with the teachers union leaders every year, and that's, I think they have 20 people maybe, so just me and 20 teachers talk back and forth for a couple hours, and I think that's really good, and I like that.
Mm-hmm. Senator Brown.
That's a good way. I like email, and I like it to come to my Senate account and also my personal Senate email account, which is at liz.brown, because then if I forget, my LA remembers whatever the meeting or whatever it was. So usually it's a double email. That helps me.
Very good. I want to thank everybody for the questions that were submitted. We did not get to everything. We tried to talk in generalities in some instances, so the specifics of some of your questions might have been lost there. We should thank these individuals. They stayed already much longer than we said they were asked to stay. That's in part because you had such good questions, so thank you all very much. I want to make sure that we also thank the Northwest Allen County Schools Board of Trustees, as well as Superintendent Himsel, who will be coming up here in a second, Chief Communication Officer Lizette Downey, and then the Charger Advocates for being here. And please welcome back to the stage Superintendent Chris Himsel, please.
Superintendent, before you start, I wanted to compliment Andy's father, Michael Downs, because I took government classes at IPFW for him, and he's part of the reason that I'm in an elected position today is because of his dad.
And I'm also up here to ask us to thank Andy as well for being here tonight. I am going to keep this short. I also took the Iowa test of basic skills. I'm not as old as they are, though. I'm pretty sure of that. My test scores did not count for any accountability or placing a label on anybody, though, and just like yours did not. I know there's people here who couldn't believe I was being that quiet, but what I wanted to do is to come up here and say thank you for all of you for being here. Thank all of you for coming out tonight and taking time out of your busy schedules. Charger Advocates is trying to set up ways of having more engagement and learning about the process. So if this was of interest to you, if you learned something tonight, please watch out for future Charger Advocate events so that we can try to educate and help people get engaged in the process so that we can have meaningful conversation about how we can move forward in a very respectful way in what's in best interest of kids instead of particular ideology. We're all in this for the same reason. I truly tell you, my interactions with each of these four members, even when we disagree, it's with great intention that we're trying to make things better for children. And sometimes there's just multiple ways of getting there. But we need to continue to advocate, but you can't advocate if you don't get educated. So please pay attention to Charger Advocate events. Become engaged in the process so that we can continue a meaningful conversation. Thank you for being here tonight.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Northwest Allen County Schools for organizing this event, and special thanks to Christopher Himsel, Lysette Downey, and Steve Pearson for facilitating our recording. Special thanks to Andy Downs for moderating the discussion. Our music is by Mark Waldick, Noah Campodonico, and Kurt Remke. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Our production assistants are Monica Blankenship and Michaela Velton. Until next time, thank you for listening. From WBOI, Fort Wayne.